This is the Cosmic Citizen. This is Andre Traversa with my lovely co-host Paula Thompson. Hi, Paula.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, we are going to, speaking of Pacho Manchin, we're going to have Pacho Manchin on our show in about 3 weeks on the 20th of September, and I really look forward to that. And tell all your friends and anybody who might be interested, because he is just a great artist and a great example for the Urantia movement. Anyway, today we are going to speak with, well, our guest today is Larry Mullins. Larry Mullins is a longtime reader of the Urantia book, found the book in 1968, didn't really start reading until 1974, is what he told me. He is also kind of a Urantia book historian. He has written a book called A History of the Urantia Papers. And we're going to be talking today specifically, not really so much about the history of the movement itself, but about the origin of the book. Because one of the things that a lot of people will say, that some people, in fact, I know who are, when I first tell them about the Urantia book, they get upset. They're like, well, how did this thing start? It all happened in secret, and Dr. Sadler found papers in his drawer and all this other stuff, and people get very upset. So we're going to talk a little bit about the origin of the Urantia book. Larry Mullins, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, thank you, Andre, and thank you for letting me be on here.
You're welcome. Larry, I want to, by the way, for callers who want to call in, our number again is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. And I'd like to focus, callers, just so you know, you can call in and ask about just about anything, but I really would like to focus on the history of the Urantia Papers prior to 1955, prior to the publication of the books. I really don't want to get into all kinds of post-publication divisive issues that divide the Urantia movement here. So anyway, Larry, you know, I guess the first, we can't assume that our listeners know all these all the things that happened around the time of when the Urantia book was first, when the revelation was first given to us. So I guess let me ask me my first question to you, I guess, is what got you interested enough in this subject to even start writing a history?
Well, you know, in the early days of the movement, there was so much secrecy, especially in the 70s. When I got into the book, after my daughter died, I had a 13-year-old die. I read the book from cover to cover and twice in about 3 months. And I was passionately interested in believing in it, and it was wonderful. But what it was very strange was there was so much secrecy about where the book came from. We didn't talk about it. We had no idea. It was very, very strange. When Clyde gave it to me, he mentioned that Dr. Sadler had put in his appendix of the Mind at Mischief reference to a sleeping subject. And then that...
Wait, I want to stop you for a second, Larry. Because,
yeah, sure.
Because I want to make sure... Again, we don't know who's listening, so let's start right from the beginning.
Sure.
Who was Dr. Sadler?
Well, Dr. Sadler was a very famous psychiatrist in Chicago, and he was a debunker of psychic phenomena. He was evidently that's who he is, and I can go on from there. That's who he was. I mean, I can go on from there.
Well, yeah, go ahead and tell us more.
Yeah,
tell us more.
Early, very early in his career in Chicago, approximately between 1908, possibly in 1911, we can't really nail down the exact date, he came across a very strange case that baffled him, because not being a believer in psychic phenomena, he couldn't explain what was taking place. That was the origin of the Urantia Papers.
Okay, well, can you tell us a little more about this case? What was going on?
Yes. What happened was he had just moved to Chicago, and one night, now this is how the story goes as he told it. One night, there was a knock on the door, and it was a woman in distress who knew that he was a doctor as well as his wife, Lena. And she explained to him that her husband was having a problem. And at that point, he went to this lady's apartment and found this gentleman. And this gentleman was in some type of what Dr. Sadler thought at the time was some kind of a trance. And he took his pulse, and it appeared to be normal. but he couldn't awaken him. He stuck pins in him. He whatever he did just wouldn't waken this gentleman up. So what happened at that point was they actually waited. At certain points in this sleep he had, he would seem disturbed and startled in the bed, sort of shakes the bed a little. But there was not a sound from him, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. When he finally woke up, Dr. Sadler asked him how he was, and he said he seemed very surprised that people were surrounding him, that two doctors were there. He said, "I feel fine. There's nothing wrong with me." He said, "Well, you know, you've been in a very deep sleep, and I'm very concerned about it, and I think it would be very wise of you to come and let me examine you." So he did, and the doctor found nothing wrong with this gentleman, and they sort of let it rest at that point that he seemed okay, didn't seem to have any bad effects. So that ended the matter for the time being, but within a short period of time, again, the lady came and said that he was in that sleep again. And this took place several times. No messages were given. He just couldn't wake him up. This baffled Dr. Sadler. And then suddenly there was one very important moment, and that was the first contact. They were in their new residence, the Sadlers. By that time, they'd moved to their what is now the Urantia headquarters. Their home. It's a very large home. They had moved there, and they were called again, and they went to this gentleman. This time, Lena, who was Dr. Sadler's wife, said something that triggered the revelation. She said she saw that the sleeping subject, as we called him now, was wetting his lips with his tongue, and she said, maybe we should ask him a question. It seems he wants to say something. So she said, "How are you feeling?" And at that moment, to the astonishment of everybody, this person spoke, but not in his normal voice. And it appeared he claimed to be a student visitor and a being from another planet. This was totally shocking to the people there. Both the doctors at that point, both Dr. Lena and Dr. Sadler, both felt that what was happening was what they call automatic speaking. In psychiatry, automatic speaking is just a phenomenon. So he decided to verify that diagnosis. Do you want to just keep telling the story?
Yes, go ahead. Keep going.
Well, to verify the diagnosis, he took him to his office a few days after that, and he figured he could find out that the source of this thing probably came from the subconscious mind, so he hypnotized the subject. And it took him quite a while to get this subject under. They call it under in hypnosis. But he did succeed. And at that point, he could find absolutely no subconscious awareness of the information that was being discussed in this by this
point. Okay, let me stop here for a second.
Sure.
Because one of the things that a lot of readers, a lot of skeptics of the Ranch book would say, they'd say, well, you know, this revelation came from this person's subconscious mind. And, of course, that's what Dr. Sadler initially thought, because that's what he felt was happening with the vast majority of people that he saw who were in trance states. Now, I don't remember where I saw this, but I saw this on a Urantia forum recently. Somebody brought up the point that the revelators, the superhuman beings who authored the Urantia papers, actually didn't use this man's subconscious mind. They bypassed his subconscious mind, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They used his thought adjuster. That was what they needed.
Okay. Okay, so go ahead, keep going. Now, but before you go any further, I want to just ask another question, which is, you're talking about things that happened, you know, close to 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, and so listeners are going to say, well, how do you know what happened? You weren't there. So what did you, in order to do the research on this, what kind of stuff did you look at? How did you arrive at the conclusions you came to?
Well, that's a long story, but to make it very quick, Meredith Sprunger first told me this story.
Now, who is Meredith Sprunger? For
he is still alive. He's in his 90s. He's the only living colleague of Dr. Sadler. Both of them had religious background. Both of them.
Well, wait. I got to correct you there. That's not entirely true because I know Carolyn Kendall also is alive, and she worked for Dr. Sadler.
No, but not a colleague. Dr. Sadler and Dr. Sprunger both had degrees in divinity. Both were masters.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And both were psychiatrists. Both were psychologists. They both were really giants of to call a colleague, you know, intellectually.
Okay, Meredith Sprunger was a psychologist? I knew he was a pastor, or a minister.
Absolutely. He was a practicing psychologist. He was
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Very, very, very adept.
Meredith is with the United Church of Christ. Is that correct, Larry, for many, many years?
Yeah, I believe that's right. That's right.
Yes.
Great, wonderful man.
Okay, so you spoke to Meredith Sprunger about these things.
Yeah, he did the original research into the origins because as a minister, he was a practicing minister. He and 11 other colleagues got copies of the Urantia book and wanted to find out what the origin was. As all revelations have to have an origin. So they proceeded to meet with Dr. Sadler and got the basic story from him. Then at that point, Meredith went into very strong research as to discover exactly how he could verify the information that he was getting.
Okay.
When I met him, he told me this story, and that was the first time I'd ever heard things like this. It was absolutely blew me away.
Was this a while before you began working on your book?
Well, yeah, once I started working on my book, then I started getting other documents from other sources and also relying on about 15 other Urantians with considerable experience with the book and history.
And how long? And how? And when did Meredith tell you this first story? What, like around? Was it in the 70s?
Right around. You know, I wrote a book called Jesus, God, and Man, which was based on the Urantia book, and was a multimedia in Oklahoma City. And I met Dr. Sprunger, and he was just the most wonderful man, most open about the questions I had about the origin. About approximately 1976.
Okay.
And anyway, when we started researching this book, which is in 1990-something, there was so much more we found out at that point. More and more things were coming out at that point.
Okay. So to get us back to the story, we were talking about this sleeping subject who was in his deep sleep was being used by these celestial beings who were coming and going to different planets. And so Lena Sadler first asked the first question. She said, how are you feeling? And this being apparently, what was the answer? The being said that he was a student visitor?
Yeah, exactly what he said. Didn't exactly explain, but I think we left.
You were at the part where Dr. Sadler has this guy in the office and he is investigating more thoroughly his condition, trying to ascertain whether or not it's coming from his conscious mind or his subconscious mind, and you were about to say what he discovered about that.
Yes.
That it was coming from his subconscious mind?
Okay. Meanwhile, back at the office.
There you go.
Okay, he discovered that he could not find any source whatever of the material, nor any interest by the subject in what the material was. So he was baffled. He just had no scientific answer. At that point, he called in some other people. One was Sir Hubert Wilkins, who was an expert in spiritual phenomena, and also Howard Thurston. Now that may have happened down the line because he didn't meet. But all these people investigated and tried to help him find. He was going to find out the source of this thing, and he did not believe in any kind of psychic phenomena. He was determined to find it out. Now, his determination lasted 20 years before he became convinced that the papers were valid.
So would you say, Larry, that Dr. Sadler was a true skeptic? I mean, he was a skeptic in the truest sense of the word.
Almost to a point where you can't believe how skeptical he was.
Yeah.
There's a point where he comes a little later in the story, but I'll just give you a prelude to it. He had memorized a great number of questions and he had a photographic mind. He was going to challenge the next visitation, challenge whoever the personality was with these questions. And the personality, he didn't tell his wife even. At a certain point, he asked this personality, he said, "How can I know you are who you say you are?"
Okay, well, now let me stop here a second, Larry, because do you believe that the Revelators chose Dr. Sadler on purpose?
Yes.
Because of that reason, for that reason, because he was such a skeptic?
Two reasons. He was such a skeptic. He was extremely reputable, integrity, and also his wife was a very spiritually enlightened individual, Lena. Probably, I believe, one of the exceptional people on the planet, really.
Wow. And let me ask you. So he, as a skeptic, they chose him because. The reason I think they wanted a skeptic, and see if you can confirm this. I think the reason they wanted someone was a skeptic. It's sort of for the same reason they chose the sleeping subject they chose. They didn't want someone whose own illusions and delusions would get involved in this process, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So go ahead. So he asked them, he said, how do I know you are who you say you are, right?
Yes, the visitor said, "I cannot prove who I am, but you cannot prove I am not who I say I am." And then he said, "But however, I can answer 48 of the 56 questions which you have memorized and are in your mind." Now, at that point, Sadler had to know there was some kind of mental telepathy going on, because his wife said, "Will, you don't have any questions, do you?" And he said, "Yes, and exactly 56. And at that point, the visitor started answering the questions.
Do we have any idea what some of those early questions were?
No, I have no. I could never find an answer to any of those.
Okay.
But an interesting point, though, is that at the end of this, the visitor said, "If you knew what you were in contact with, you wouldn't ask such puerile and stupid questions. You'd ask questions that would be challenging and for the good of humankind."
Okay, now, everything I've read has indicated that what you just said was directed towards the Contact Commission itself, not towards Dr. Sadler.
Not according to history.
Okay.
No,
the Contact Commission didn't even exist up until that point, did it, Larry?
Right.
That's exactly right. So now, what we have then is what Dr. Sadler would later call a re-education of him and Lena and the Kelloggs, who were the two Kelloggs with Wilford and Annabelle, I believe. That was the sister. She was the sister of Lena, and they were also on the Contact Commission at that point.
What was her name?
There was two: Wilfred Kellogg and Lena. I believe it's Annabelle. I think it was Annabelle.
Now, who was Lena's sister? Is what I'm asking.
Annabelle.
Okay.
So those four people went through a period of almost 20 years of re-education, 18 years. Dr. Sadler said,
I have to stop you right here, Larry,
uh-huh.
because I just want to sit with that fact for a minute. Most people can't conceive of that. You know, it's not that many things in our lives that we spend 20 years doing. And so in order to take this in, people have to understand that Sadler, the two Sadlers, Dr. Lena and Dr. William Sadler, literally went into this man's room when he was in a profound state of unconsciousness and talked to these entities and these beings from other worlds and other places in the universe for 20 years. This went on for 20 years.
Amazing.
And to me, that's an astonishing fact. You know,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, although this wasn't the only thing they were doing. He had a busy business, he had a big practice. His wife had a practice. I think it was very peripheral to him. He was mildly interested in it. He often lost interest in it, and Lena kept him interested in it. And that's one of the reasons I believe she may have been a reservist.
A person of
reservist.
Destiny.
That's right. Because she kept the spiritual flame alive. He was not... he wasn't that believing in what was going on. He couldn't figure it out, and it was just beyond him.
Well, now, you mentioned this question that the being asked Sadler, or, you know, he kind of threw the gauntlet down. He said, you know, if you were talking to, you wouldn't ask these questions, but
right.
you would come
now, remember, that happens much later, so we jumped ahead.
Oh.
The story. So we don't have a forum yet, so we want to say how that happened. But imagine 20 years of doing this, and he didn't realize it, but he had been programmed in it, all his religious thinking. And it was as though they were testing him and preparing him for greater things, and him and Lena and the Kelloggs. So at a certain point, the forum was formed, and I'll explain how that happened. It was about approximately 1923. And he was on a trip, and he had suggested before that they get together some of the patients and friends that they had to get together on Sunday to have a tea and talk over philosophical things. And while he was gone, he was notified by his family that they had set it up for Sunday. And when he came back, he would have his first forum meeting, which became the forum. At the time, it was just an informal group of people. It was only put together for general philosophy. There was nothing about the Urantia book, whatever, at that point. So they formed this thing, and Clyde Bedell got in it about that time. It's interesting to me that he started very early. But he said there wasn't much. He didn't think it was anything much going on. It was just kind of interesting, and he would go there with his future wife. Now here's where it took a very interesting spin. He had developed those questions, as I remember, you know, as told you about. And when he was challenged by this entity to come up with some good questions, he became pretty annoyed and to be challenged the way he was. And he went back and he told his wife he would really come up with some questions that they couldn't answer.
Yeah.
Now, the next meeting of the forum, or shortly after that, they were there. They came. Somebody asked if there was anything to this. There was a guy performing in Chicago at the time who was kind of a mental telepathist or something like that. And he immediately said no. He said there's nothing to it, with only one or two exceptions. All psychic phenomena I've investigated is fraudulent or conscious or unconscious, but it's just not true. And now here's where the key question came in. Somebody said, what were the exceptions? Doctor, if you found something that is an exception to that, what is it? And that's when he told about the sleeping subject. He said, I just haven't been able to solve it. I'm working on it. And he kind of explained a little bit about the subject. And then he told him about the questions. It came about that they said, well, let's ask questions. And so everybody got excited. And he said, all right, everyone come up with the toughest questions you can, and we'll challenge this guy. I don't know, there's different versions of how many they finally came up with, but probably several hundred. And they classified them, got duplicates. And now they were waiting. They were loaded for bear. They were waiting for this next session to take place so they could challenge them. Now, that's Dr. Sadler and Lena were waiting. You know, they wanted to try these questions out on this entity or whoever happened to show up. Well, suddenly they get a phone call several weeks later. It's the lady, the wife of the sleeping subject. And she says, please come over here quick. And he said, Doc, he asked what happened. Is he sleeping or what? She said, he's sleeping. Well, he's asleep, all right, but that's not it. You got to get over here. So they dressed very quickly and got over to the apartment. And they found this huge manuscript, handwritten, and she handed it to Dr. Sadler. And he said, where did this come from? She said, I don't know. He made strange noises in his sleep that awakened me. And then I spotted this on his desk. And Sadler said, did he get out of bed? No, he didn't get out of bed. I don't think so. He was right here. But he was making strange noises. There were nearly 500 pages of handwritten text. and they were addressing 181 questions that the forum had asked, of the questions that they'd asked. And then he asked Dr. Squid.
I just want to clarify something. Had Sadler previously given the sleeping subject questions?
Yeah, now that's what's fascinating about this, Paula, is this guy was so scientifically grounded and refused to believe in mental telepathy that even then he didn't say, my God, this is something remarkable. What he did say was, we never thought there was anything psychic or spiritual about this whole thing. I knew I could find the answer sooner or later. But isn't that remarkable that he still clung to that?
It is, and you know, that's something that I never knew. I thought that Sadler actually gave the sleeping subject the questions and the answers came through shortly thereafter, but he never actually even gave him the questions, huh?
Nope.
So you're saying, what you're saying is essentially that the beings or being or whoever read Sadler's mind and Sadler never actually gave the questions.
Well, I don't know if they read his mind, but they certainly read the questions somewhere. They must have written them down somewhere.
Yeah, this is interesting because I'm not saying, I think it's interesting to note that your book is called A History of the Urantia Papers, so it's your own, perception of what happened, because I've seen other accounts, you know, which seem to indicate, you know, that the Contact Commission as a group were the ones that asked this question, that essentially, from what I was told that the Contact Commission got this 20-year re-education you're talking about, and that the manuscript didn't come through until after this 20-year re-education, that the Contact Commission had, and the Contact Commission was the one. I mean, I was told basically that they were kind of fooling around and asking silly questions, and then finally, you know, one of the beings said, you know, if you knew what you were in contact with, you'd ask questions that were... I mean, you're saying that was something he said to Sadler, not to the Contact Commission.
Yeah, we document everything. Everything is documented. So I can't go into it now, but believe me, this is as close as we can come. And 15 Urantians agreed when we showed them the documentation. I'll say it's called a history for... You can thank David Cantor. I wanted to call it the true history. And he said, Larry... You're going to turn off everybody if you try to say something like that. So I said, okay, so we called it A History.
Okay.
So anyway, let's see, where were we? We've got the manuscript.
We got the manuscript, yeah. Okay. And what about what time was that, you think?
When the first manuscript came through. It was right around 1924.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That was well before... Well, before the dating of the first papers, then. Well, before the actual dating of part one.
Oh, yeah, there were no papers at this point. At this point, there was even still no forum. So Dr. Sadler decided that he would get this typed, because now he has another problem. It's not automatic talking anymore. It's automatic writing, evidently.
Okay.
Here's a very, very important issue about the writing.
Okay.
Did you want to say something more?
Well, no, I was just going to say then this manuscript showed up in the man's handwriting, and yet
not in his handwriting.
Okay, in somebody, it was handwritten though, right?
Right. Now, the handwriting question is I can go into.
Okay.
But this is a very tough psychologist. So here you have a bunch of manuscript. So now, how do you account for it? Okay, the first thing he did was now Christie was living with him at that point, a very young Christie. He had her bring over something to measure the fatigue in the subject's arm to see if he'd been writing all night, and there was absolutely none. The next thing he did was, okay, if he didn't write it last night, because he'd have to work at seven, eight hours, to produce a document, and the content was so complex that he doubted anybody could write it. So he thought that maybe he wrote it over a period of months and then called him in. Maybe it's some kind of a fraud. And even though the wife had sincerely testified that it wasn't, he decided to get a handwriting expert. Now, we delved into this with great care. Dr. Sprunger said that a woman named Clara Stahl was a CPA. Told him that she was there when they did the testing of the sleeping subject's handwriting. and the manuscript, and they said that there was no they could not determine who wrote it. They tested Dr. Sadler, they tested his wife, they tested the Kellogg's, and they could not determine, the experts could not determine who wrote it. Mark Cuban.
So you're saying it was not, since it was not his handwriting, that already rules out the idea that this was automatic writing.
Yeah, and if it was in his handwriting, there would be no way that Dr. Sadler would say that it was anything but automatic writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, he's not going to say that it's not automatic writing. And went through it. The simplest solution would be somebody else wrote it if it's a different handwriting. And that's what it was. Mark Kulicki said the same thing in his book. He said the contact group speculated on the possibility that the writing was that of a secondary midwife. And that seems to be what the consensus was when we went through all the people, including Bill Sadler, who contradicted that later, but he definitely told Dr. Sprunger that it was in the, he thought it was a secondary midwife, and so did his father. So the handwriting thing is whatever it is. It's gone through in great detail in the history, but you can check it out and make your own judgment on that.
None of those original manuscripts exist still, do they, Larry?
Oh, no. They were all destroyed. Now, here's the midwives destroyed the manuscripts. They were put in a safe. They would disappear, and once they were typed, and that was that. They wanted no trace of the original document, nothing that was possibly materialized by some miraculous way. So there was no miracle. Nobody ever saw anything miraculous. That's very important. None of the contact witnesses saw anything that they could call miraculous through this whole process. They were protected from seeing anything. If there was something that had to be moved or done by the midwives, they were told to leave the room. And
wow.
They never saw anything. And they were dying to see something. if it was in the handwriting of the sleeping subject, it'd be impossible to tell future generations that it wasn't automatic writing. No one would believe it. So anyway, you can make your own judgment from that. But anyway, he takes the document. He has it typed. He takes it to the forum. It's a huge document. And they're astounded that he reads it to them. Now, the date that he did that was 1925, January 18th, 1925. That was the first reading. And Clyde Bedell was there. And he said he didn't even remember anything about it. He said he didn't know there was an epical revelation going on. Much of the forum was the same way. You can imagine, how could you suddenly come to the conclusion that this is an epical revelation? But they liked the material. Now, the questions that they were told, they began to develop questions at that point. They were like a focus group. They would listen to these papers, and somehow the midwives would know by their reactions how they were taking this material. They were also permitted to ask questions if they had it about the material, and that process started at about that time. It was not till 1925 that it became the forum, and the people there were at the original forum. I forget there were about 40 some members.
Let's clarify for the listeners, Larry, the difference between the forum and the Contact Commission.
Oh, the Contact Commission at that time finally consisted, by the time this all happened, it consisted of Dr. Sadler, Lena Sadler, and the Kellogg's.
So that's Wilford and his wife?
Huh?
Who's
Wilford? Wilford and his wife, yes.
What was his wife's name?
I'm going to look for this thing.
No, but what I'm also asking, though, is not just a question of the people on the Contact Commission. What I'm also asking is, what was the purpose of the Contact Commission and what was the purpose of the forum?
The purpose of the Contact Commission was to somehow receive this material and safeguard it from any harm or changes. The purpose of the forum was like a focus group. They were to listen to the material and react to it.
They would ask more questions, right, Larry?
Exactly. They could ask all they wanted. Now, when they had a pledge they had to make, and this is kind of interesting. I have it right here. It was 1925, September. They said, this is the pledge they all had to take. We acknowledge our pledge of secrecy, reviewing our pledge not to discuss the Urantia revelations or their subject matter with anyone save active forum members, and to take no notes of such matter as it is read or discussed at the public sessions, or make copies or notes of what we personally read.
Okay, let me ask you something. Why do you think the revelators were so adamant that that this stuff be kept secret? Because I can just hear someone saying, I can hear so many objections from people saying, this is crazy. This is, you know, why should this all have been kept secret? You know, I can see people either saying, you know, there's no way to verify any of this, or I can also hear people say, you know, this sounds like some Gnostic cult. That's what a lot of conservative Christians would say. They'd say it's some Gnostic cult of elite people who claim to have secret knowledge. This whole thing is, you know, suspect. I mean, you know, how would you, I guess I have two questions. One is, why do you think the revelators were so adamant about this stuff being kept secret? And secondly, what would you say to people who raise objections like that?
Well, I don't know exactly what I'd say, but I would say this about the revelation. In a perfect world, none of this that I'm telling you would be told. It was supposed to be kept secret. How the papers came through, and the sleeping subject himself, all of that was supposed to be a spiritual mystery and die with all the contact commissioners. They were, being human, started spilling the beans to certain people.
Okay, but again, why do you think they wanted it kept secret? Why do you think the revelators wanted this to be?
Well, here's why. They did not want the Urantia papers to be based on some miraculous appearance. They did not want them attached to any specific individual, so they'd worship them like St. Paul or something like that. And Clyde, in fact, when he gave me the book, I said, who wrote it? He said, supposedly it's written by angels. And I said, oh, yeah. He said, but that, don't let that stop you. He said, even if it's miraculous in its origin, he said, that's the worst reason to believe anything. Just let it be the content of the papers that you go by. And that's what it should be today. And so I would say that to these people.
See, okay, but then how do you, again, skeptics are going to say, I mean, one friend of mine in particular, he said, you're a journalist, Andre, because I've published journalism before. He goes, I'm incredulous that you would believe this. He's like, you're saying that, I told him, I said, the content is what matters, not the origin. And he goes, so what? The Mormons say the same thing about their Book of Mormon. And he said, you know, what do you ask in journalism? Who, what, where, when, and why? You know, those are the five questions you ask. I mean, that's one of the things that you know, that's one of the objections people are going to raise. How would you respond to that objection?
Well, what I would resort to would be a true academic from the Cambridge University Press. They have a book called The Invention of Sacred Tradition. It's fairly new. And they studied the Urantia papers. A woman named Sarah Lewis. These are all highly acclaimed academics. First thing she says in her treatment of the Urantia papers is say, the way the Urantia revelation is said to have emerged is quite unlike that found within most other traditions. So there's no special person involved. There's no great figure involved. There's no certain way. We just don't know how these papers came to be. What I'm telling you is the best we can find out now, and I wouldn't be telling you again if so much misinformation hadn't been put out. That was threatening the revelation itself, I felt, that we had to just dig out what we could and get out the truth as we could find.
Okay, when you say that misinformation was put out, what do you mean?
Well, there was, getting into probably areas that we shouldn't, but basically, many people were saying that Dr. Sadler wrote the papers.
Okay.
Now, interesting, I'll tell you just a comparison.
No, that's still germane to what we're talking about here.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Don't worry.
The lady that wrote this paper went into great care to figure out if the papers were written by a single person. They determined that at least 9 different authors were involved. They compared it to Dr. Sadler's writing, and none. There was no matches whatever. Ken Glassow did the study, and they honored it at the Cambridge University as accurate. Now, these are theologians who have no axe to grind as far as they're not telling you whether it's true or not, the revelation itself. They're only saying that this was written by a great number of people.
Mm.
I have a question from one of the writers on our board, and Charles in New York, and he says, in your opinion, Larry, what is more significant about the UB, its origin or its content?
Well, without question, it's content. I would say that, and I say this all the time when we start arguing about who knows the most about the papers, there's no authority on the papers on the planet.
You're here.
And probably the person who knew them best that I know of and practiced them best was Mother Teresa, and she didn't have a Urantia book.
Yeah.
Which
so it is the content, indeed.
And speaking of comments from listeners, I'd like to remind everyone again that if you'd like to call in, our call-in number here, as you can see on the screen, is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158.
Hey, Andre, I need to mention also that I see a couple of callers have tried to call in. I just want to tell our listeners to please give me a chance for a natural break in the discussion so that I can get your call in. I hate to interrupt when, you know, some important things are being said and questions being answered. And so hang in there with us. Don't give up. I will answer your call. We've had two callers that called and then hung up. So I don't know. I hope they're not experiencing technical difficulties where they're getting booted off. I think maybe they just decided to hang up. But I do encourage you to hang on, and I will get to your call as soon as there's a break in the conversation.
Sure, and I can break any time you want.
Okay.
There's well, anyway, here we have the typewritten manuscript, and we have the forum. And it took a process of about 5 years went by. One of the reasons it was kept secret at that time was that it was a work in progress. They weren't ready to show it to the world yet. They wanted to test it with the focus group and massage it until it was correct. So
that actually, to me, honestly, sounds like the most credible reason to keep it secret. Because, you know, otherwise people might start tampering and wanting to put their own agenda into the paper.
Oh, they did. They did early on. There were quite a bit of that. They were told, in fact, there was somebody on the forum wanted to include something they thought would add a great deal to the papers, and they were told absolutely not. There would be no human intrusion on the papers. And then Bill Sadler and Dr. Sadler decided that once the papers were completed, they decided, well, let's just add a forward. So they wrote a forward, and boy, did they get slapped down. They said, no way. A candle cannot light the way to the sun. And
wow.
They eventually developed their own forward that they wanted.
Okay, Larry, we have a caller. Hold on. I'm going to put him through. Hi, area code 240. You're on Blog Talk. Cosmic Citizen. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello. This is Vic.
Hi, Vic.
I'm impressed with the show. I know Larry. He's a friend of mine. I'm impressed with the way you all are handling the discussion. My question would be, is there going to be a rebroadcast of this in the future? Because I got a late leg up on this thing, and I just found out about it today.
Well, you can, Nick. You can all our shows are available to be downloaded. So, and not only this show, but all the past shows we've done are downloadable. So you can, after about an hour and a half or so after the show, it should be available for download.
Okay. Thank you. Second thing is, Larry, you're coming across young and vigorous. I'm glad you are.
Well, I got him faked out then.
Yeah, how about that? And I'm pleased with the way you guys are, you hosts are handling this from a journalistic viewpoint, because you're asking the right kinds of questions, and you and Larry seem to be syncing together. That's my only comments.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Vic.
Yeah, Vic, thank you.
Okay.
We got another call. Hold on.
Hello?
602. Area code 602, you're on Blog Talk.
Hey, Paula, Andre, and Larry, it's Eric Kosh.
Hey, Eric. How are you?
Hi, Eric.
Good. I just wanted to let you know I'm online here with you guys, very fascinating, and giving you my full support.
Oh, good guy. Appreciate it.
Do you have a question, Eric?
Do you have anything you want to add?
Nope, no questions.
Well, we just got two amen choruses of support. That's good. Thank you for the cheerleading. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, well, that's better than nothing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So we were talking before about the you were saying that one of the reasons that this was kept secret was to because it was a work in progress and they didn't want people tampering with the papers and that kind of stuff.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of apocrypha, and I really should tell you this, that all we're talking about now is not revelation. It's only, there's a lot of speculation, and we don't know for sure a lot of these things. One of the things that was interesting that that Meredith Sprunger told us was Dr. Sadler tried all kinds of tricks to catch these revelators. And one of them was he put $20 bills between some of the pages of the
right. I remember reading about that.
Yeah, and the papers would disappear and the money would still be there.
Now is that I know that I saw that in Mark Kulicki's text. Obviously there's no way to verify that, but did you get verification of that from Meredith Sprunger as well?
Oh yeah, that's where it came from.
Okay,
I would trust Meredith.
So you probably looked at multiple sources, and you probably looked at, if you got confirmation from multiple sources.
At least two sources for anything.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Unless I had a hard copy of something.
Okay.
So anyway, then plus another time he put it in a bank vault in a safety deposit box to see if they could get it, and they did. And they told him to quit fooling around, that they were serious, and then not to do things like this. So it's these kind of funny little things that took place. So anyway, we have this going on, and now some people ask why this leaping subject was necessary once these papers started. They used the thought adjuster of this leaping subject, not his mind. Somehow there seems to be some kind of rule with revelation, according to Dr. Sprunger, that a human thought adjuster would make sense, that they would want to use some part of a human or some contact of a human relative to the planet that would make sense with any kind of revelation. So that was whatever that is. Then in 1929, they decided they told the revelators told the commission, now they're not talking to the forum, only to the commission, that they thought that the forum had learned quite a bit, and they said, with your increasing understanding, and by the way, the forum could read the papers too. They couldn't take them off the premise, but they could read them on premise, premises of 533. Anyway, your increased understanding, you can now ask more intelligent questions. We're going to go through the book again. The whole process started all over again in 1929.
Here, we got another caller, you guys. Hold on. 518, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, Paul and Andre. This is Charles in New York.
Hey, Charles.
Hi, Charles.
And
hi,
hello,
Charles.
Larry.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm very well. I wanted to ask, in your opinion, Larry, which is more significant in terms of talking about the importance of the book, its origin or the content?
Absolutely the content. The content is absolutely the most important thing. In fact, I explained it. Let's just imagine we were told there was a revelation coming through, and we went to a house, and there was a guy floating around in the air, and papers were coming out of his mouth, and we said, this is miraculous. That would be the worst reason to believe anything. The content of the book is what we should base our belief on, whether it resonates with us or not. And the book itself tells us that.
And Charles, let me just address that comment you're making on that question, because I agree completely with Larry that the content is more important. The only reason I'm doing this show is because the origin has become such a it's something that's two reasons. One is it's something that skeptics are going to address. They're going to say, you know, I actually told one guy the origin was irrelevant, and he just got so upset. You know, and the other thing is the origin is being discussed. If you go to Wikipedia, for example, online and look at the article about the Urantia book, you know, the origin question is addressed. So it's already there. It's already out there in the public discourse. So I can't, you know, there's not really any way to avoid discussing it at this point.
Oh yeah, and I think it's great to discuss it. I think it's very, very important. And I'll just throw this one more thing in, and I'll get off the line. As far as the content and the origin of the book, it seems to me that if the Revelators had chosen to give this information in some absolutely, totally unique fashion, no one would have ever understood it. It would have been so out of the ordinary that it would have been incomprehensible to anyone.
That's a good point.
So thanks very much, yeah. Larry.
Thank you, sir.
And this is maybe this is a question. I'm sorry, Paul. You were about to say something. Do we have another caller or?
No. Charles, are you done? Are you still on with us?
Yeah, I think he's off.
No, I'm still here, but I'm done.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Thanks, Charles.
Anyway, I want to just raise one other question. It's kind of it gets us off track slightly. Okay, but it goes back to what our caller Charles just said. He said if this had been given in some completely unique fashion, we would not be able to understand it. Well, I guess I'd say two things about that. In a way, it was given to us in a unique fashion because nothing like this had ever been done before. The sleeping subject's mind was bypassed, you know, that kind of thing. It wasn't done through automatic writing. It wasn't done by any means that we can understand. Having said that, we also know, we're going to talk to Steve Dreyer about this in a couple of weeks. We know that the Revelators used human sources, and they were instructed by their superiors and their supervisors to make use of whatever existing human sources they possibly could, and to only resort to pure revelation when no previous human expression of the same concept was, you know, had ever been articulated. Now, do you think that the Contact Commission, Larry, and the Forum, do you think they knew about any of these human sources and where these things were coming from and the books that the Revelators used and things like that? Do you think that was something that was familiar to them, or do you think that's something that was later discovered by people like Matthew Block?
Well, I think as time went on, they found sources that were, you know, used by the Revelators. But they made no attempt to hide that in the foreword.
That's right. It's also in the acknowledgement in Part 4. It's even more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Absolutely. Interesting. I found that quote by Dr. Sadler because the idea that this is so new is a very important idea that Charles brought up. What he said after the 20-year period, he said, we never realized how much our religious thinking had expanded until the papers began to arrive. As the revelation progressed, we became more fully appreciative of how we had been prepared for the vast alteration of our religious beliefs by these preliminary contacts extending over a period of 20 years of pre-education.
Right, and you know, and the other thing that's interesting is even though the Revelators did use human sources, the flip side of that is there's a lot of material that has never been presented before. In fact, I remember reading in the appendix of The Mind at Mischief, Dr. Sadler said that you know, the content of these revelations is essentially Christian, but he said, on the other hand, he said its philosophic content is quite new, to his knowledge, he's never seen anything like it before.
Absolutely. Also, another question came up was some people say that the Jesus papers were added by Dr. Sadler and they weren't. Jesus wasn't even mentioned in the early book. It's amazing someone could say that because Jesus is mentioned as early as page 30.
Yes.
And 19 times before you reach 100, the Christ Michael, the Son of Man, and the Son of God. How can somebody say that you know, how can make that statement that, you know, it was added on? Because it just wasn't. There's another point that we should talk a little bit about, and that's before we go further, and that's the fact that many people don't understand that the complicated process that took place that brought us the papers. They had to be translated. They had to be translated from a very complex language of Yuversa, in some cases, and to the language of Nebadon, and again translated into English. And some people,
wow.
Some people say, well, you know, I love the real words of Jesus. I don't like people to paraphrase the words of Jesus, but Jesus never spoke in English. So everything that he said was translated.
And there are places in the book, by the way, where we're not getting the words of Jesus. There are places, for example, where they say, in modern phraseology and in substance, Jesus said. And we know when they say that, that they're probably using a human source.
That's very true. That's very true.
You know, and well,
I have to add something here, you guys. Larry, you mentioned that Jesus of Nazareth is mentioned for the first time in the book on page 30, and I would like to read the context of that mentioning.
Well, you're watching them. I better be careful here.
Yeah, it's you know, it's great. It's paper one, the Universal Father, the very first paper of the book, very first chapter for people who aren't familiar with what we mean when we say the very first paper. It's from section 6, Personality in the Universe, page 30. You were exactly right. This is what it says. It says, God is spirit, spirit personality. Man is also a spirit, potential spirit personality. Jesus of Nazareth attained the full realization of this potential of spirit personality in human experience. Therefore, his life of achieving the Father's will become man's most real and ideal revelation of the personality of God.
Yeah, that's great, Paula. I'm glad you
said
that.
That's the first time he's mentioned, and as you said, If you search in the context of Jesus of Nazareth in quotes, just Jesus of Nazareth, not to even mention Michael, Christ Michael of Nebadon, just Jesus of Nazareth comes up 98 times in the book.
I do remember that in paper one it does mention Michael before it mentions Jesus, but you're correct. You know, having said that, you're correct that they Well, are you saying that they use the word Jesus, they use the name Jesus more than they use the name Michael in the book? I think they do.
Oh, no.
I think they do.
I don't know, but she's right about that. I mean, I think what we're saying is that he's woven all through the...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Really
part
is.
One
is,
Mary, yes.
You pointed out to me one time that this book really is a book about Jesus. It's about him past, present, and future. And even in the cosmic sense, and I think that is so true. It's a book about many things, but it's primarily a book about our Creator, our universe Creator. I think one of its main purposes is to get us to know Him well, and know who He is now in His cosmic sense, and as the sovereign of our universe. But also who he was when he lived a life on this planet. So I really want to, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You know, some people will say, here's the interesting thing about that. If you took the revelation itself and looked at it as a whole, and say it's about, 1,300 pages of prophecy, it covers a period of 400 billion years. Now, if you think, okay, the last 773 pages are about 35 years. Now, compare the amount of time relative to emphasizing Jesus to the 400 billion, and you'll get an idea of the importance of the 35 and a half years of one man's life. In fact, a third of those 773 pages are only 7 days of Jesus' life. So you get an idea of the importance. Clive Bedell wrote this, the first 1,300 pages of the Urantia book are preliminary to the last 800 pages, the most important 800 pages of print on earth, the life and teachings of Jesus. The 800 pages are not to support the first 1,300. The first 1,300 pages in the Urantia book provide an immeasurable cosmic backdrop, an infinite setting of support for the Creator of our universe, living a life and on a mission on our teeny planet.
Let me just say that we are halfway through our show, and again, anybody who wants to call in, please do, 646-716-8158. I want to ask you something, Larry, about documentation. Now, you don't cover this in your book because it wasn't it wasn't around back then. But recently, Square Circles Press has published the Sherman Diaries. There was a guy named Harold Sherman who was involved in the forum. What is the significance of that? Why do you think that that's such an important document?
Oh, I think it's very valuable. I think Saskia and Matthew Block, they did this, and they really copied those diaries completely objectively. They didn't, at least I can't see any doctoring in it. What they prove is open to question. They think they indicate something different than I think they indicate. The most important thing they do is they completely discount the book that Sherman wrote earlier.
You mean later?
Papers. Yeah, well, later. I mean, 1970s, but, you know, before these were put out. His book in 1976, I think, How to Know What to Believe.
Well, actually, the book was called Pipeline to God, and the chapter is...
Well, the chapter is Pipeline.
Yeah, How to Know What to Believe, yeah.
Yeah. Let's backtrack,
Larry. Let's backtrack.
Sure.
Who was Harold Sherman?
Well, Harold Sherman came in at the point when the forum was suddenly told that there would be no more forum. It was in 1942, May 1942. They were told that there'd be no more questions, that the text would be frozen. This was really a downgrading in the forum. I think that was demoralizing in a way.
Wow.
And so the papers were to be set in type, and that was it.
Hey, Larry, at this point, some of them had been participating for 20 years, right?
That's right. That's right. And Clyde was one a little bit annoyed by all this. Now, what was taking place was something that would, I think, plague the revelation for a long time. Who would control the papers? It's submerged. It's always people well-meaning to think that they need to protect them. But what happened at this point was Dr. Sadler began to, or it had been going on for some time, forming a two organizations, the Foundation and the Brotherhood. Clyde took exception to the fact that the forum was being cut out of all this, and he kind of made buddies with Sherman. And when Sherman came in at almost that same time, they really felt disgruntled that they were being cut out from any kind of input or information about these organizations. So they got together quite a few members of the forum, and there was a large number. And they presented Dr. Sadler with it wasn't an ultimatum at all. It was called a rebellion, but it really wasn't. It was a plea to him to let these people get in on this process of forming these organizations. The way that was handled was very unfortunate. It was just too bad that Dr. Sadler wasn't more open to the some kind of a input in democracy at that point. So that's what started it. I really believe Harold Sherman it was sincere in his heart, and Clyde was sincere in his heart. Dr. Sadler just rebuffed this. He was very annoyed that this took place. And
But I want to get back to we're talking here about origin of the paper. So I want to get back to Harold Sherman. Harold Sherman was was he a member of the forum then?
Yeah, he joined the forum and he took the pledge. But in contradiction to the pledge, I'm going to say, you know, this is human folly that's going on here by everybody. He took the pledge, but they started writing down after the meetings everything that took place.
Is that what was in his diaries?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I want to explain to the listeners something, and that is that Harold Sherman, correct me if I'm wrong, was involved in, he was sort of the opposite of Dr. Sadler in the sense that he was not a skeptic of psychic phenomena. He was kind of involved in psychic research and things like that, correct?
Yeah, see, he wasn't, that's just a true statement, I think.
Okay. So I want to say that here, that when we say that the Sherman Diaries are a valuable document, you're not defending Harold Sherman and saying that later, because he wrote, I guess I want to explain to the listeners that Harold Sherman wrote a book called Pipeline to God in the 70s in which he essentially poo-pooed the Urantia book and said it was all a bunch of hogwash. and he actually didn't even use Dr. Sadler's names. He used a bunch of fictitious names in the book. And there's a chapter in the book called How to Know What to Believe. And in that chapter, he basically poo-pooed the Urantia book, and said that it was all a big scam. But you're saying that his diaries, though, were not, in his early diaries, he was very much a proponent of the book.
Yes, he was, and he praised the book, and he praised the Jesus Papers, and he had a cohort named Harry Luce who told him that he would be one day the great leader of the Urantia movement, and people would see his apartment and say, this is where he once lived. He continually massaged the ego of Sherman, and Sherman, that's one reason I think he was with that process, the Call to Rebellion. He believed all this, and I think he felt that he would be the one that could do better to disseminate the papers than Dr. Sadler. He thought they were stultifyingly boring, the forum meetings, and Dr. Sadler had no idea of how to promote anything, and Clyde felt sort of the same way. Now, Clyde, as soon as the Dr. Sadler rebuffed this attempt, Clyde went back into line and stuck with Sadler. Sherman and his wife continued to attend the forum. Now, that's a place that people, if you read the diaries, I'm sure he was there. Now, when I say they're valuable, I think that they pretty much prove that Dr. Sadler did not doctor the papers, in my judgment, but the reader will have to do that. They'll have to read them for themselves. They prove several things, that Sherman really distorted the facts in his book, How to Know What to Believe. The diaries themselves, though, are very fascinating because you get an insight into the humanness of the forum, that these were ordinary people fussing, fuming, doing things that are good and bad and indifferent, just people like us.
I agree, Larry. I enjoyed that. From that point of view, I enjoyed reading the Sherman diaries for a couple of reasons. One, because here was a firsthand account of a person, although he was disgruntled, and that comes through in his diaries still, it was a firsthand account of he and his wife. They sat through these sessions at the forum. They listened to Dr. Sadler read the most recent paper, or William Sadler Jr., one or the other of them would read, and they would discuss, and then either Sherman or his wife would give a synopsis of what they had heard. And I often found that the synopsis they gave in their diaries, and you have to keep in mind as you're reading them, this is their personal diary, that they would give a synopsis for their own sake, and it was a very good synopsis. I found
agree.
That many of their synopsises of the paper were very good. And I really enjoyed reading from the sake of, I feel like I know some of the characters now who were involved, and they were going through very real life situations. They were losing loved ones, they were getting ill, they were, you know, but week after week after week they would show up at 5:33 by bus or by car, by whatever means they had, and sit and listen to these papers being read, and for the most part they were all sincerely impressed with what was being said and what was coming through.
Yeah, that's fairly good. The one thing I think we might have a little caveat about that would be, at a certain point, the revelators, there was, you remember the formation of the 70, Paula?
Yes.
The 70.
What was the 70? Explain that.
The 70 were, there happened to be 70 people that volunteered to study the papers in greater depth on Wednesday nights.
That was separate from the forum.
Well, they were in the forum, but these were people who were going to give extra time and study more deeply.
So were the 70 all forum members, or did they also include people from outside the forum?
Oh, no, just all forum members.
So how many people were in the forum eventually?
There was a total, you know, they would come and go. There were quite a few people that would come for a while and then drop out. But when it was all over with, there was about 460.
Really? And these were all people from the Chicago area?
Oh, yeah. Then they'd come
really?
And leave. And then, not all of them believed in the papers. You know, some of them probably didn't.
Didn't they all have to be interviewed by Sadler before they could come, though?
Yeah, they did. That's
yeah.
true.
And why, Larry, why do you think Sadler was so secretive about it. Do you think that this was something that the revelators had told him to be secretive, or do you think he had some personal motives for being secretive as well?
Well, I think that, you know, he did tell Dr. Spranger, and Spranger didn't meet him until he was about 82. Dr. Sadler was 82. He met him after the papers were published. But Dr. Sadler told him that there were only two things that they were told they absolutely had to do. One was to keep secret the name of the identity of the sleeping subject. And the other was to not to tell what they know about how the papers were materialized. And the reason for that is he said that they didn't know. And the little bit they did know would only confuse people. So the revelators really believed that, I think, that better to keep this completely a mystery, not to have it based on some kind of miraculous, person or means of transmission.
Well, we have a question on the board too, and this is something that has always intrigued me. As Andre knows, I've told him that I'm really intrigued by this character Harry Luce, and how he fits into all of this. Can you kind of give us an opinion on that?
Well, you know, Harry Luce to me was, I'm trying to be as kind as I can to him. He believed in far more psychic phenomena than Sherman.
Even more so than Sherman?
Oh, more so. He's far over the top. And
okay, let me ask you something. Was Harry Luce a forum, or Luce, was he a forum member too?
He was very early on, evidently, in the forum. He spoke to Sherman about the papers, and he, doing it from memory, he got a lot of things mixed up. For example, he'd say there were giant birds as big as mastodons that could carry 12 people on their back. This is so far out that, you know, it's just staggering, some of the things he imagined. He also said that there was a group of hybrids that came to this planet. They were formed by celestial beings coming down and mating with creatures like lemurs, but they weren't lemurs. And the progeny of these matings were these strange people that were half spiritual and half human. Now, he said this was in the papers, not in the papers at all, and that Harold Sherman was one of these people that were trapped and reincarnated into this planet with special missions, and so was Harold Luce as well. Well, you know, these are pretty far-out things. They weren't in the papers, Sherman thought, well, Dr. Sadler's taking them out. As you read this in the diaries, you begin to realize that Harry Luce was a loose cannon, let's put it there.
You know, I hate to say this on the air, but I just can't resist. I can't resist noting the similarity between Harry Luce and Lucifer.
Well, I don't know. I think he was just deluded. I think he just he believed some of these things. I think he got carried away with his... the book itself says, and this is an interesting thing, the book itself says spiritual genius is often accompanied by egoism and narcissism, and Jesus was fully free from anything like that. But you see that in some of these people that are wonderfully spiritually inclined. The narcissism.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
You see grandiosity and instability and narcissism and that kind of thing. So basically what you're saying is that Harold Sherman... I want to reiterate to people that Harold Sherman initially believed in the papers, but eventually rejected them and fabricated. And in his book, Pipeline to God, I read the chapter, I Don't Know What to Believe, which was is a chapter, it's online, by the way, for those who want to read it. I don't remember the website offhand, but I Googled it. Harold Sherman gets a lot of things wrong in there. He gets the dating of the papers wrong. He says, you know, he claims, as you say, he claims that the book never mentions Jesus in the earlier parts, and the paper, you know, then suddenly they add Jesus as an ad. I mean, there's so many things that are wrong in that section, but it's just interesting how somebody could understand the truth at one point and then gradually get it all distorted.
It's sad. When we do the history, another edition of it next year, we'll make it available in a e-book and things like that. we'll change, we'll adjust that by some of the diaries, from the stuff from the diaries. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm absolutely convinced that there was no distortion of the papers when they were delivered by Dr. Sadler.
You know, you bring up such a good point to me, and I had an insight as you were talking. If the doc, you know, because you said that, you know, you were talking about some of the things that Lou said about giant birds and stuff, and I thought, well, you know, the papers do concur with some of that. We know it does talk about the Fandors who are now extinct that could carry a passenger, and that Adam did fly over the garden on the back of a Fandor, it also says that Adam himself was over 8 feet tall, that his skin had a violet hue, and that Eve was over 8 feet tall. So now these are some really big people, and you know, some would say upon reading that, that's outlandish. And
sure.
It occurred to me as you were speaking that if Sadler had written it, I think he would have edited some of that out.
You know, I totally agree with you. I think so, too.
But you know what, though? But you know what?
Pardon?
I was thinking it's also easy, though, to see how somebody, I think, how somebody could have mixed some of those things up. Because some of those things are similar in a way to what's in the papers, but they're distorted. You know, I'm just saying I could also see how someone might have mixed those things up, especially when a person is not entirely stable, you know, like what you said about Harry Luce. You know,
well, we should leave that, but I do think one other thing to that, the belief in psychic phenomena, there are things that we don't understand. I'm not a rebuker of psychic phenomena totally, but the things that I didn't believe that Luce would say was, for example, he could travel astrally to South America and meet with this priest, and the priest would come back and meet with him, and they would sit on a park bench and converse through astral travel. Well, I have trouble with that whole concept. Sherman did believe that. So that's up for people to decide.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to keep bashing Sherman here, but I just want people to understand. The only reason is that even though we believe that the Sherman Diaries are valuable, that I'm not here defending his character or his integrity, because I do believe that his belief in psychic phenomena contaminated his ability to, or his I shouldn't say just his belief, his intense focus on psychic phenomena, I think, you know, tainted his ability to see the papers objectively eventually.
Well, you know, I'm going to say something controversial here. My opinion is if Dr. Sadler had handled that situation with the so-called rebellion more judiciously, he probably could have won Sherman over and eventually persuaded him. And that, I think, was a great sad thing about that great tragedy. Because I think Sherman was really good-hearted, believed in what he was doing, and gradually got angrier and angrier as he and just slipped off his cog, I think.
You know, I have to absolutely agree with you, Larry, and I would have said, before I read the Sherman Diaries, I don't know Harold Sherman from anybody, but after I read them, I could see how this whole thing progressed, and it needn't have progressed the way it did, and I have to agree with you that I think Dr. Sadler very much mismanaged the whole thing. He could have been much kinder to the whole forum. In fact, he was very much into this idea that, he had his little pets, and he would invite them up to the top of the building to a special place so they could hang out with him while everybody else had to stay down below and stuff. And he kind of set a lot of these feelings, these hard feelings. He set them up, and it was troublesome to Harold because Harold was a very talented man in his own right, and he had many gifts that he wanted to lend to the publication, but the promotion of the book that he wasn't allowed to give. They weren't accepted. They weren't wanted. And I think Clyde Bedell felt some of the same things.
I do, too. I think Clyde's what was done was the twig was bent at that point. There was an inner circle in this movement that began at that point. It exists to this day. there was a switch from democracy in the sense of a true democracy to a different form of handling things. Now, I think that the Revelators probably let this happen. Their mission, in my opinion, was to get this book as perfect as they could get it into the mainstream, the evolutionary mainstream. They had the right guy to do it, and they did that. And how the humans handled it at that point, they knew would be up to the thought adjusters, and the human folly would probably prevail.
Okay, I'm gonna ask you a really controversial question because I really don't want to get into this, but we almost have it. If I understand you correctly, you believe then that the Revelators set up the Revelators are the ones that set up the foundation of the Brotherhood then?
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
So you believe that was a human? Okay. Folks, I want you to know that I'm remaining neutral in this discussion. I am not saying that Larry is right or Larry is wrong. So I really don't want to, you know, if people get, I know that's going to happen. Someone's going to give me flack and say, how could you let Larry on the air and say this stuff? Well, it's just Larry's opinion, okay?
Oh,
we don't know, you know, so I'm not suggesting that, you know.
Andre, what did Larry say that's so controversial? I mean,
well, he just said that he doesn't think that the Revelators set up the Brotherhood or the Foundation.
Well, why is that controversial?
Because a lot of readers would say that the Foundation was supernaturally set up, and that the Brotherhood was supernaturally set up by the Revelators.
There's documentation to support that.
Yeah, well, I'd like
to. There is documentation to support me.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's in the book. I would say that you have to, my opinion is, you have to look at the results. We got 10,000 copies of the original text printed. That's what we own. Well, there was 2,500 copies that I printed later, but of the original text exactly as it was sent. The Foundation keeps three copies of the original 1955 text. And Keeler told me that was their obligation, was only to keep three copies of the original 1955 text in their possession and protect it. The problem is that nobody gets to see those three copies, and they don't agree with any of the printings that they made after that.
Mm.
That's my position. Now that's the result of a human folly, not the result of the midwares setting up an organization.
So you're saying we don't actually have the most of the copies of the book that are being published today are not the original text?
They're very close. I mean, no one would be hurt by reading them. They're fine. The question is, there's no keeper of the text now, and I'm not the one that says there should be. The midwares said that. The midwares gave the.
Okay. We're kind of getting off into. Let me ask you this question. One of the things that I have always said, and I think other people have confirmed this, is even the papers, the first three parts are dated 1934, I think, and the last part is dated 1935. Although maybe part three is dated 1935 as well. I don't remember. But anyway, even though the papers are dated in the 30s, I believe there were some revisions that were made by the Revelators prior to the publication of the book, and here's why I say that. There are a couple of reasons. If you look at Part 3, there are a couple of sections that seem to have been added later, and the reason I say that is because they seem almost like parentheses or addendums that are sort of there by themselves. I'm thinking of two in particular. One is the section on the limitations of Revelation, okay, where they say that a lot of the scientific statements will have to be revised and things like that. That section is in one of the religion papers. And it doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything in the paper itself. It seems to be sort of, it doesn't flow very well from the previous sections of the paper. It seems like they just kind of stuck it in there somewhere. And I wonder if that was a response to further questions by the Forum or the Contact Commission about the nature of Revelation. But the other thing, though, the other section I'm thinking of is a section at the end of paper 82 about racial mixtures, where they start talking about how there's nothing wrong with racial mixing, and you know, racial mixing is okay, and that, you know, most of the objections to it are based on social and cultural prejudices. Now, there are two reasons why I think that was added, why I think that was a later addition and was not the original, you know, that was, you know, added. One reason is because some of that was taken from a book called Race, Man's Most Dangerous Myth by Ashley Montague, which was written in 1941. The other reason that I say that I think it was added is because it seems to be an attempt to correct, to kind of soften some of the harsher rhetoric on race that is in the earlier papers of Part 3. So do you think there were some revisions that were made by the Revelators prior to 1955?
That possibly. They certainly could have done it. You have to remember Adolf Hitler was on the march.
Yes.
And his ideas of eugenics were extremely dangerous. The book itself says that there should be never an attempt to create genius by breeding. It's very clear. It says that the genius will spring from ordinary people, from the ordinary ranks of
right.
people.
Right, right.
That's such an important part of the philosophy of the book.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the Urantia book's teachings on genetic are more, certainly in my opinion, the universe is more interested in our social behaviors and our tendencies toward one another. Certainly we should eliminate somehow debilitating diseases. And with the Genome Project, that's becoming more and more possible, I think, and a lot of things are opening up to us. But when the Revelers talk about genetic tendencies, I think they're more honing in on unspiritual types of tendencies that are troublesome to our history. And at least that's the way I take it. So.
Well, there's people out there, I think, that have wiring missing. I mean, it's how could you to kill people? It just doesn't make sense. I should say, too, that if some people want copies of the history, that you can download them free on freeurantia.org. That he has them on his website, freeurantia.org.
www.freeurantia.org?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A great site.
That's
a lot.
Now that we're going to revise just the part about Sherman in a later edition next year. But if people are just dying to get a copy, that's one way to get it. You can buy used ones, but they're expensive on Amazon. They're getting like $80 for a copy.
So Larry, I'm curious now. You've kind of covered a long period of time. Is there any way that you can kind of just do a synopsis of the timeline so far? I mean, we started back in maybe 1911 when the first contact with the Sadlers and this man's wife happened. And, they first were made aware of these papers. And then for 20 years, they did some preliminary investigation of this phenomenon with this man that we call the sleeping subject. And then in the 1920s, the first group of individuals was evolved around this phenomenon. And then from there it grew into, say, by the 40s, there were 400 people perhaps involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, no. I mean, that they had come and gone. That many had come and gone. So there was
okay.
never more than 40 or 50 people on the forum at a time.
Okay. And then what happened after that? I mean,
They disbanded. Well, the forum no longer existed, but they called themselves the forum. They continue to call. They still do to this day. People that arrived after 1942 weren't really in the forum. They were in a study group. But after that, now we have the final preparation for the printing of the book.
And I want to back up a little bit because I have always heard that the papers came through, and they do date themselves. They often give dates in 1934, 1935. I have always heard that the bulk of all of the papers in the book that are contained in the Urantia book came through in those 2 years. Is that true?
I think it was the book itself was just about done, I mean, as a huge final thing about that time. However, they continued to revise them. Clyde Bedell said they went through them two or three times before they were frozen, and there was a revisions made all the time. He tells...
Was that prior to 1955?
Oh yeah.
That,
well,
so,
this
so
was
that kind
before
of confirm,
they
may, that may confirm what I was saying earlier about the Revelators, about possibly, you know, that some of the things in the papers I think were added after 1935.
And what about?
Well, okay. Now this was up to 1942 when they were frozen. Now, if the Revelators did anything after that, I have no knowledge of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
I don't know. I'm just saying after 35.
But you know, when the Jesus papers came in 36 or so, they were revised too. They were read through just like the rest of them, and there were changes made. Clyde said that there was there's a very famous statement made that the forum, when Dr. Sadler read somebody had a very good sense of humor for a Jew. The forum was white Anglo-Saxon, pure white group, laughed at that point. And the next time the paper was read, that was deleted by the Revelators.
Right.
So the focus group is in progress this whole time.
Wow. So those are the kinds of things that they fine-tuned it. And, you know, we talk about Apocrypha, and I have a personal feeling about it. I really appreciate all the research you've done. And I think someone on the board said, you know, why should we speculate about the origins of the Urantia book, especially when we're believers? And I think most believers I've met are very interested in the origins, even though the origins don't really affect whether they believe in the teachings or not. They believe it anyway, because obviously there is no information about the origins. If you just pick up the book and read it, you would know nothing about how it got here. So I really honor your service in doing this research.
Oh, thank you.
I have a personal problem with a lot of the Apocrypha in the movement, because
it's interesting,
but people will drag it out like it's canon, like it's law, and we should all snap to and pay attention, because
because
for me, if it's not in the pages of the book itself, I don't feel like I'm obliged, you know. Why should I be? I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of readers out there who don't care. They don't bother to get involved with anybody, and they're going to do whatever they want. But I should snap, too, because somebody said, a Revelator said this or that way back when, and they heard so-and-so tell so-and-so tell so-and-so, you know.
I
understand how hard it is to get to the bottom of these matters, because there's no firsthand. I mean, even Meredith had to hear it from Dr. Sadler, and you had to hear it from Meredith. You didn't ascertain this from Sadler himself, right?
Exactly. Well, you have to understand, there were 15 people involved doing this. Now, Joan would say exactly what you just said, Bo. If it's not in the book, it's not Revelation. I totally agree. Not only that, they were supposed to destroy all this. They were instructed that all the Apocrypha was to be destroyed. So when somebody drags something...
Well, yeah, that's why... Let me see Apocrypha, too, and what needs to be destroyed. Let me also clarify that apparently there were some communications that were given by the Midwayers to forum members, like in 1943. I've seen some of these. There was one online called the 1943 communication. And I guess the original communication was destroyed, but apparently there were notes taken by people in the forum. And they weren't supposed to be taking notes, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and they did it anyway. Now, I think one of the reasons that those things are supposed to be destroyed is because in those communications, the Midwayers comment on political issues. And they say, for example, we should have gotten involved in World War II earlier. We should have intervened, you know, and stopped Hitler before he was able to. And I think the reason that those things were meant to be destroyed is because, I mean, I know one reader, for example, who tries to take those statements and apply them to contemporary political situations today. And I think that that's exactly what they don't want us to do, because, you know, those statements were made, you know, at that time for particular reasons. And, you know, and if for us to say, well, then the Midwayers then support all kinds of global interventions today, you know, you can't really say whether that's true or not. And I think that that's probably why the communications were, I think that's one reason at least why they wanted them to be destroyed, because they didn't want them to be used out of context to justify someone else's political opinion in the future.
Yeah, not only that, there's doubtful origin. We don't know where they came from. There are changes. There's different versions of Apocrypha. they're changed a lot. We document all that, and there's just no basis for any Apocrypha to be used. It should all have been destroyed. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Human folly again.
Right, and it's our tendency to want to venerate. It's just what the book itself says, you know. Just a perfect example of this very fact. They tell us that there's the Council of 4 and 20, and every 100 years, one of this council, including Adam and Eve, John the Baptist, there's some very illustrious Urantians that sit on this Council of 4 and 20 and advise over issues of the rebellious planets, or the planets that are in rebellion. And every 100 years, one of this 4 and 20 comes here and acts as a resident governor general for the seraphic or the spiritual planetary government. And they tell us, the revelators tell us, we'd like to be able to tell you who this individual is at present, but we don't, because you humans so easily tend to venerate your superhuman compatriots.
That's so true.
And I think therein lies the problem. We have a tendency, and if our planetary history had worked out the way it was supposed to, and if Adam and Eve were here, I like to imagine what it would be like right now, living on this planet, knowing that there was a cultural center that had existed continuously for 37,000 years or 38,000 or whatever, however long, and that these beings were still here. They are our universe representatives. They represent us to the universe. They represent the universe to us. They've lived continuously on this planet for 37,000 years. They're mom and dad. If we have a problem, we can go to them. We wouldn't have this void in our lives, our need to have some contact with celestial realities, with spiritual realities, because we would have them. They would be our contact.
But you know what? That's true. But you know what's also interesting, Paula, is that, you know, we are also, the book says, Agendonders. So we are, our faith is tested and deepened in a way that those on the humans on normal worlds don't have to wrestle with.
Well, I know that's true, but I'm just pointing this out because I think we tend to venerate every little thing that's extraordinary.
Exactly.
And we call it miraculous, and it's not. It's just like they tell us again later. You know, you humans call many things miraculous that we think are ordinary. And I think that's our, you know, we have to be careful that we don't tend to venerate things. In my opinion, when we do, we end up hurting each other for their sake, and that misses the whole point.
Well, you know what I find miraculous? Is I go to sleep at night, I surrender consciousness, I wake up in the morning, and I'm still Larry, and I can remember this continuity of consciousness that exists, and it's the same Larry that was 6 years old, and I know that. To me, that is an utter miracle, and as you get older, that becomes so much more important.
That's beautiful, Larry. Thanks for sharing that, because it's an act of faith just to go to sleep at night. You never know if we're going to wake up in the morning. But
as you get older, these things occur to you.
That's so true. Well, you know, the Apocrypha, and I find it just as interesting as anybody else, but I try to take it with a grain of salt because...
Well, they used it for a means of control. That's what bothered me so much. When I first got in the movement, they talked about the mandates, and the mandate said this, and the mandate said that. Nobody ever saw them. And then when they finally came out, it ended up they were part of a document. It was a mandate to publish the book. That's all it was. And all these different things that you had to do this, you had to do that. You could not quote a sentence from the Urantia papers without permission of the higher-ups. You just couldn't do it. There was such stringent control that eventually, I think it destroyed their control of the papers altogether.
Well, I think you live by that, you die by it, too. You know, I think Jesus is pretty clear on it, and I think that's what happened. But, and for whatever reason, we're in a new era now, and we can celebrate that. But, you know, I got to tell you guys, when I was 22 years old, I wrote Urantia Foundation, and I said, I was listening to the radio the other day, and somebody was reading the Bible on the radio, and my heart ached to hear the words of the Urantia book read on the radio. It is so poignant, so beautiful, so clear. And I asked a sincere question. I said, why does nobody do public readings of the Urantia book? Why is this information not on the radio where people can hear it and benefit from it? And I got back the pat answer, I'm sure, Larry, about the mandates that and the go slow thing. And I remember being 22 and feeling absolutely crushed, like, how could I be so stupid as to want to share this, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
And,
well,
I
mean, here's the other thing about this whole thing about going slow, is that that's relative. What does that mean? You know, I mean, you could make the case that reading about the Urantia book on the radio would not have been that big of a deal. You know, so, I mean, you know, even if there was such a mandate, you know, again, what does that mean, you know?
Well, I think that Clyde and Sherman had that right, that we went too slow. But one of the, I think the biggest failing, Paula, in my opinion, with the movement has been the failure to evangelize to our children.
Oh.
We started a children's group, Joan and I, when Michelle was about 14, and by the time she was 22, we had read the entire book. It included several other young people, and they all read the entire book. Each week we'd have pizza. Claire Thurston brought her children every week, and we'd eat pizza, and we'd read the book, and we'd read a paper. It was the most wonderful experience I've ever had. There's a story that I heard about Moe's little boy. I forget his name, but when they gave him a book when he was about, I forget, 8 years old, finally, or 10, he put on his shirt and tie, ran and sat in the chair, and just sat there with the book. He could barely read it. But we have not really evangelized to our own youth, and I think that's a very sad thing.
Well, I have to agree with you, Larry, and I think we can certainly get better at that and better at a lot of things. And my only reason for mentioning my experience at 20 is because it's come full circle for me. Every Saturday I read quotes from the Urantia book on the radio.
That's wonderful. I can't tell you
what a full circle experience this has been. I mean, 33 years later, I'm reading quotes from the Urantia book on the radio, and to me, it is the most beautiful material ever written. I wish, you know, I often tell people, I wish there was a word good enough for it. There just isn't. And, you know, you can't give someone a spiritual hunger when there is no spiritual hunger. But if people are hungry for truth, if they're hungry to make sense of a world that doesn't make much sense a lot of times, the Urantia book is the best thing available for that. And so it really is a full circle, and I honor you for sharing it with your children. I think we all should. My children were raised with it. I made no apologies about its teachings, and I incorporated its teachings every time a question came up. They didn't have much of an interest in reading it, but I think they will. I have faith that they will. And
well,
we were lucky,
Michelle. I'm sorry. Michelle, when we told her we were going to read the papers, she said, at last. So we were very fortunate.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I just want to get back to the origins, because I know I kind of took us off track here, but you had said that
Let me say one thing before you say that.
Sure.
Paula, if you think you're a voice in the wilderness when you're doing your radio show, remember, you're getting a standing ovation from the angels. Always keep that in mind.
Andre, did you hear that?
I sure did. Thank you for the affirmation. That's very much appreciated. But we've been getting affirmations from callers today, too, so that's even great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, what I was going to ask was, you talked about the mandates, and something that's always been of interest to me, and again, it's apocrypha, it's just interesting to me, that I have always heard that they were told not to publish the Urantia book before 1955. But the way I've heard that is, they were told If you don't hear back from us after a certain point, after 1952 or something like that, then you can go ahead and publish in 1955. Is that what you've heard too?
That's very close to being right. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, they had a special dispensation, my understanding is, they were not to publish the papers until the sleeping subject died, but somehow they got some kind of a dispensation that although the sleeping subject was supposed to be still alive, they were allowed to go ahead and publish it.
Okay, and from reading the Sherman Diaries, I never before felt how important that was to that group of people who were spending every single week in the home of Dr. Sadler listening to these papers be read, how monumental it was for them. I mean, they were anxiously awaiting. They anxiously awaited the publication of this book in book form for, gosh, 15 years?
Can you imagine?
Then to have it in their hands, to have a book in their hands that they could, that all of a sudden they were free to share. And what I've heard was they wanted to share it with everybody and not many people were interested.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They sent them all over the world and they got people. They thought that this would change the whole world as soon as they sent them out. And people would say, oh, my God, we've got... But what they didn't realize was that they had been conditioned the way this 20-year preparation, the world was not. And it was just nothing happened. They just sent them out, nobody, very little happened.
Which could be why they were told, you know, this is really meant for another generation. It was told to them as much that they wouldn't get discouraged as anything.
Well, they were told, too, that they wanted to train teachers and leaders. And we are, all of us. We're the teachers and leaders that are supposed to be here. So personally, I think that we shouldn't be sitting at the feet of anybody. We should be out there teaching ourselves. If we're afraid of the people out there, then teach our children.
I agree. Anybody that we can, any audience we can find that's open and willing. And I have, you know, I've done introductions to the Urantia book for many, many years, and I was never invested in how many showed up. Only in the fact that whoever was there was supposed to be there. And I always would vow before I did an introduction to the book that, Father, you know, these people, most of them may never pick up this book and read it. So what I would like to do is leave them with one nugget of truth from the book that they can keep, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Yeah, for me that was scoring a home run.
Well, you know, Bill Sadler Jr. said that at one point the revelator said, you probably will live and die without knowing that you're part of a spiritual vanguard for a renaissance on this planet. And, you know, that's very touching to me. You know, it's a pretty amazing statement. And I also think of Susan B. Anthony when, you know, she died way before the women got a vote. But one of the last things she said in public was, failure is impossible. And I truly believe we have a chance to remake the world. And failure is impossible. And just if you feel like you're a voice in the wilderness, just remember those angels are giving you a standing ovation if you're out there trying to do it.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it's funny. Normally, I'm much more talkative today, but I'm listening to you guys today. Normally I have a lot more to say, but this is all very interesting information. I don't, I'm just kind of taking it all in. So if you're wondering why I'm not saying anything, that's pretty much why. So.
Well, it's a wonderful experience. I truly enjoy it, and I hope that we, I really feel that if we all believe in the values of truth, beauty, and goodness, if we all subscribe to that'll take down all barriers, and we don't have to argue about anything, that we're all faith children at least, and maybe all the argument and stuff like that will go away someday.
You know, the way I look at the history of the Urantia movement and the origins of the Urantia book and the fact that it was steeped in secrecy, I completely understand why it needed to be. And I understand why that culture developed. It's like the Shell, you know, how the ministering reserves tell us no chick can be had without the shell, but no shell is of any worth after the chick is hatched. And I think that that was the shell that the Urantia movement and the Urantia revelation gestated in. But I think the culture, the secrecy, the culture of secrecy, I mean, even when you go as recently as a few years ago, you go to 533 in Chicago, 533 Diversity Parkway, where Dr. Sadler had his office and where many of these transactions happened, you would have to buzz to be let in. And it looks like a fortress. The building itself looks like a fortress. You can see how, you know, this was protected. It was protected very vigorously, very zealously protected. And I think that, the vestiges of that culture, which was necessary for the revelation's gestation, became, you know, hard to break free from. And I think that's just what you get. That's just the way it goes on this planet, because change happens slowly. And, you know, I have felt like since the book, since 2002,
mm-hmm.
I felt like the book was born that day, was
That's
truly
wonderful.
Born into
That's
the
wonderful.
Into the world
mm-hmm.
When it was free.
That's so true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, do you have time for a short quote from the book?
Oh, actually.
There exists in all personality association of the cosmic mind a quality which might be denominated the reality response.
Mm.
It is the universal cosmic endowment of will creatures which saves us from becoming helpless victims of implied priori assumptions of science, philosophy, and religion. This reality sensitivity of the cosmic mind responds to certain phases of reality just as energy material responds to gravity. It would be more correct to say that these supermaterial realities so respond to the mind of the cosmos. We're gifted with a reality response, all of us, and we can make up our own minds.
I love that. I love that you read that quote, because that
we get in trouble sometimes. I know I do sometimes, but believe me, I believe with all my heart anything I tell you.
Yeah, me too, Larry. That's sincerity, right?
I can tell Paula. It rings true.
And however, you know, however the book got here, I think Dave from New York's point, certainly the origins are interesting. They are important. People will ask. We all have to kind of find a way to tell that story that's satisfying to people, because they will ask and they do want to know. And it's the way that we give credit to things, especially written words. We credit them to somebody, and if it's a credible source, they have more credit. And I'm sure that it's a stumbling block for many. It was never a stumbling block for me, but I'm sure it is for many. And I'm fine with that. I have come up with a story that works for me, and it's along the lines of what you just said today, Larry, the story about Sadler and how he was drawn into this case, how he was a true skeptic. How the closer he got to it, the more intrigued he became.
Well, that's why I think it's important that we're talking about the origins, not because I think we had an earlier person who asked on the chat board why, you know, what as believers, why should we speculate about it? This is not so much for believers. It's because we're going to be asked about it. And I think to me the most important thing is that Sadler was a skeptic. I mean, I think to me that's one of the most important things.
He gave us a valid text. I think that's very important. What a gift.
Oh, absolutely. He was a good steward.
And
he was nothing if not a good steward of the revelation. God bless the man. He gave, what, 50, 60 years of his life?
And all the characters, don't you think, Paula, they all did what they thought was best. They all worked in a way they really believed was right and the best way.
Lena, too. I've heard, you know, Victoria Clark does a paper on Lena Sadler. She was one remarkable woman.
Remarkable
woman.
Extraordinary and wonderful.
Yeah. And this was a group of people who really, when you look at it, they had nothing to gain from this. It took a lot of their time, a lot of their energy. They never got any money from it.
And look at what Sadler had to lose, Dr. Sadler. He could have lost his entire practice.
Right.
And he's an amazing man. They all were amazing in their own way. And human folly being what it is, mistakes were made, but so do we. We're as bad as they are.
We fall into the traps.
Oh, yeah.
We all do. We're human, and that's the point. You know, they try to keep us from falling into these traps, but we don't see them coming. I think that's the great problem with humanity is we don't have foresight. And so we really don't see the traps coming. We inadvertently fall into them.
Well, now they're out, and we have them. And, you know, Peter Drucker said that when they look at this planet years and centuries from now and write the history, it won't be cell phones and all the amazing things that happen. It'll be the fact that people for the first time were relatively free, and they didn't know what to do with that freedom.
Yeah.
And so we have the text, we're relatively free, so let's get busy.
There's the great challenge to humanity. You've thrown the gauntlet down, Larry. Well, what a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
I enjoy it. My pleasure. I really did enjoy it. We're getting near the end here?
Yeah, we've got about two minutes now.
Oh, good. I can't think of anything really significant to say. But I'll tell you one thing. I really thought it was a wonderful experience. I appreciate it. I appreciate what you both do. You're out there doing something, taking chances, and daring, and it's inspiring.
Thanks,
well, thank you.
Thanks for what you do, too.